Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max coming to you from New York Law School and its Center for New York City Law. Thanks for tuning in for this episode of the show. It's Thursday, March 28th, 2024, and it's the day after the board of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, or MTA, gave final approval to the congestion pricing program, otherwise known as Central Business District Tolling, that is now set to be implemented in June, coming up very soon. And that's what we're digging into on the show today, congestion pricing in New York City, the details of the new program, the first of its kind in the country, but coming after its implementation in several other international cities. And we'll discuss the long arc of history to get here, what comes next, some of the promises and potential benefits, pitfalls, many question marks and variables at hand. Before I say more about congestion pricing and get to today's guest, who's a veteran journalist who's been covering congestion pricing and related matters for much of the last 15 plus years and has a lot to say about transit and street space and culture, let me just give you a couple quick highlights of things coming up here at New York Law School and the Center for New York City Law. Two upcoming in-person events you're welcome to. You got to register ahead of time, but please join us on the morning of Monday, April 15th. I will be hosting a state budget briefing with New York City Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer to talk about the Adams administration's housing agenda. There might be a state budget in place by April 15th, and we'll be able to talk about what is or isn't in it related to housing policy and the several housing policy planks that the Adams administration would like to see from the state. A lot to discuss there. And if they don't have a state budget by April 15th, we'll talk more about what the city wants from the state, where negotiations stand, and all of that. Then coming up on Thursday, May 9th, we'll have a city law breakfast with the New York City Department of Investigations Commissioner Jocelyn Schrauber. You can visit citylandnyc.org for more info. There's an RSVP form there for the Deputy Mayor Torres Springer April 15th event, and we'll have one up soon for the DOI Commissioner on May 9th. They are open to the public, but RSVP ahead of time, please. Okay, back to today's conversation. Congestion pricing will charge vehicles different rates depending on the type of vehicle and the time of day for entering Manhattan's Central Business District, basically everything south of 61st Street and between, but not including, the FDR Drive on the east and the West Side Highway. The applicable area is also being called by the MTA the congestion relief zone, and that, of course, is key to congestion pricing, is trying to reduce traffic congestion. The goals of the program are, obviously, to reduce the terrible traffic in and around Manhattan and the Central Business District, cut air pollution in the process, speed up the movement of vehicles that do remain on the road, especially city buses. And the buses are really a major problem and have been for many years. The bus speeds in the city are really deplorable, and speeding up the buses is really a key piece of all of this. And also crucially here, a mandate is to provide funding for mass transit, especially for upgrades to the subway system. The subways carry roughly 4 million riders each day, plus another roughly 2 million daily on the buses. A lot of people riding mass transit, even though those numbers of ridership are still down from pre-pandemic levels. A lot of that due to the shift to work from home policies across many sectors and industries, but also there is hope that through congestion pricing, both the charges on vehicles and the increased and improved services that should come to the subways and the buses, that more people will ride mass transit, not only getting out of their cars, but also just being enticed to return to them. Also, perhaps getting people out of some of the increase in for-hire vehicles, not just driving their own vehicles, but riding in Ubers and Lyfts and taxis and all of that. All right. The revenue and transit funding was a major motivation for the program's passage in Albany through the state government in 2019. Congestion pricing by law must yield $1 billion annually. So the group that had to come up with the tolling structure, and I'm not going to go into all the details of that. You can look it up on the MTA website. You can read about it in press reports. There's a lot of details to it in terms of the peak hours and then the overnight hours and different charges on different types of vehicles. I'll give you a couple quick data points on that in a minute, but I'm not going to go into all the details. But in designing the program, they had to figure out a way to estimate that they would get to roughly $1 billion annually in revenue, which the MTA will then leverage in bonding to bring billions more for its capital program, which funds crucial state of good repair upgrades, modernization of the existing mass transit system, especially the subways and its signals, which is essential, as well as expansion projects. The MTA capital plan right now, that's coming actually towards its conclusion, the five-year program 2020 to 2024, is for a little over $50 billion in spending. So they're basically spending roughly $10 billion a year on their capital program, again, for different upgrades, buying buses, buying subway cars, changing the signals, and all sorts of things. Plus, as I said, some work on expansion projects like the next phase of the Second Avenue subway, for example. The signal modernization is a key piece of this to help the subways run more efficiently and effectively, as well as things like purchasing electric buses to change out the bus fleet to be more climate friendly. As we sit here today, there's a lot of celebrating that's been happening about among congestion pricing supporters and advocates for mass transit. There's still a chance, though, that ongoing or coming litigation will further delay congestion pricing. Again, it's moving ahead now roughly 5 years after the law was passed in Albany to get this moving in 2019, not to mention that it's all happening now, more than 15 years after there was a major congestion pricing program push attempted by Mayor Michael Bloomberg and many advocates and others back in 2007, 2008 that did not pass the state government. Obviously, not everyone is a fan of congestion pricing back then or now, and there's ongoing lawsuits. They've been filed, including by the state of New Jersey, and then also by the Staten Island borough president, along with the city's teachers union. In short, of course, there are many drivers who don't want to pay an additional fee to drive into Manhattan. So we'll see what happens with the litigation. As of now, though, it is a very momentous occasion for the future of New York City and the surrounding area that the MTA board has given final passage of the specifics of the program and that it is moving forward unless there's some sort of court stoppage of this. The law that was put into place in 2019 left a lot of the details to be determined, and so there has been a drawn-out process for that, plus, of course, pandemic delays. For some, it's decades in the making. For others, it's the culmination of that renewed push that really started during the Bloomberg years. And then for others, maybe a bit more recently, this was in part an answer to the crisis that the subways were in that really took hold in the middle of last decade, bottoming out in 2017. And as then Governor Andrew Cuomo and then Mayor Bill de Blasio were arguing over control of the subways and oversight, but also especially over how to fund the MTA capital plan at the time, the congestion pricing program took on new life as both an answer to helping fix up the subways that were falling apart and late and having all sorts of challenges, and as this answer to creating a new sort of dependable recurring funding stream for the capital plan. And congestion pricing will cover somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% or so of the MTA capital plan. Cuomo at the time had been trying to dodge a lot of responsibility for what is essentially the state-controlled MTA. We've seen Governor Kathy Hochul take that responsibility on more fully, and that's partly because there was a real change in public perception around that time that was pushed by de Blasio, actually, in a lot of ways, and also advocates and others to make sure that people knew that the governor and the state were really in charge of the MTA, although the board does, of course, have representation from the city and surrounding counties and elsewhere. It took de Blasio quite a while himself to come around on congestion pricing, despite his self-professed progressivism. Generally speaking, this was not a sort of progressive policy that he got behind for a very long time. Democrats took control of the state Senate to have both houses, majorities in both houses in 2019, and that also helped lead to passage of the program that year. There was also a big full court press from advocates, many organizations and individuals who've been who had worked on it for decades or years. I can't list them all, but certainly key to the advocacy were groups like Riders Alliance and Transportation Alternatives and others. Again, I hesitate to even start listing names because there's so many individuals and groups that were involved over the course of decades and years. Once it got passed, they had to do a whole lot of design of the program. They had to get public input. They had to do the necessary environmental reviews and get federal sign-off. So 5 years, a global pandemic, a change in federal administrations, which was key to getting those sign-offs and permissions. And here we are. So there's a lot to talk about in terms of how we got here, what comes next. I have just the right person to talk congestion pricing and mass transit and the public realm. Joining me in just a minute to discuss this long arc of congestion pricing in New York is Gersh Kuntzman, the editor-in-chief of Streets Blog New York City and Streets Blog USA. That's a position he's held since July of 2018, and which he came to after stints at both New York City tabloids. He's been at The Post. He's been at The Daily News. He was also editor of The Brooklyn Paper. And Gersh Kuntzman has been a longtime New York City journalist for decades, covering New York politics and policy and government and transit and more. He's been covering the congestion pricing saga since that Bloomberg push, if not before. And of course, at Streets Blog, where they cover all of these issues related to transit and the public realm in great depth and detail from a perspective supporting congestion pricing and, you know, modernization of the way that streets are used and support for mass transit and all of that. Just a few other quick facts on congestion pricing that is expected to go into effect in June. I'm not going to give all the details, but a few other things that I think are important context here for the conversation. The congestion relief zone, the Central Business Tolling District, gets roughly 700,000 vehicles entering the Central Business District of Manhattan every weekday, 700,000 vehicles. So they are estimating and hoping that congestion pricing will reduce that by roughly 100,000, somewhere around 15 to 20% reduction in vehicle traffic into the Central Business District, which would be a remarkable achievement. Of course, they estimate that there is $20 billion worth of wasted time and lost productivity because of gridlock in Manhattan, which, by the way, has gotten much worse over the last decade, decade and a half. The MTA says that average travel speeds in the Manhattan CBD is about 7 miles an hour, which is a 23% decrease since 2010, they say. Congestion pricing revenue will, of course, fund a lot of the signal upgrades and other things that I mentioned, accessibility improvements for stations where there is no accessibility for people, modern signal systems, electric buses, and other things, a lot of capital program at stake here. There are a number of discounts and exemptions to the program. I'm not going to go into all of them. Those can be looked up online. They include a discount for low-income people who need to drive and people with disabilities. There are also a lot of exemptions for certain types of vehicles, school buses, for example. Lots of city worker vehicles will get exemptions, but there's going to be real questions about the specifics of that because not every city government vehicle will get an exemption. So there's more details to be worked out still there. But a whole bunch of different exemptions and other things there. But the basics of the program are that there will be a peak period and the off-peak overnight period, okay? And the peak period for weekdays is 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. and for weekends is 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. For vehicles, small commercial vehicles and the regular passenger vehicles with paying with Easy Pass will be charged $15 for entering the Central Business District during the peak period. And that drops down to $3.75 during the overnight period where there's less congestion. They're trying to move more vehicle traffic into the overnight period, especially deliveries that will obviously apply a lot less to just regular passenger traffic. But the regular sort of toll for regular vehicles, passenger, small commercial vehicles, $15 during the peak period, $3.75 during the overnight period. Trucks and buses will pay either $24 or $36 during the peak period, depending on their size and function. And that drops to $6 or $9 during the overnight period. Again, there will be some exemptions for certain buses and certain trucks. There will be an additional charge on for-hire vehicles and taxis for trips into the Central Business District, $2.50 per trip for the app-based for-hire vehicles, $1.25 for the traditional taxis and green cabs and black cars. There are credits for people, vehicles entering the CBD if they've already crossed a tunnel or a bridge that has a toll nearby. So there's a whole complicated system there so that people aren't fully double tolled, so to speak, and a whole bunch of other details to the program that you can look up. One more note on that. If you live in the congestion zone and you just are driving around in the congestion zone, you actually won't be tolled. You will only toll once you leave and then come back in. You don't even get you don't get tolled for leaving. It's only a toll for anyone for coming into the congestion zone. So for those that live in it, if you leave, no toll, but then as soon as you drive back in, you would get tolled. And again, there are some exemptions and discounts and credits and so forth and things like that. So I won't go into any more detail there, but there's a lot more information online. And we're going to discuss a bunch of things with Gersh Kuntzman in just a minute. Very briefly, if you've missed any recent episodes of the show, I've had a bunch of excellent guests on a variety of topics. We've had a lot of focus in recent weeks on state budget negotiations in Albany, which are coming down the home stretch here. My recent guests on that topic have included assembly members Catalina Cruz of Queens and Brian Cunningham of Brooklyn. I also recently had State Senate Deputy Leader Michael Janaris of Queens on the show. Some great conversations with those legislators and others. I won't go through the whole list. We haven't only been talking about the state budget, though. I've had some recent guests, including New York City Health Commissioner Dr. Ashwin Vasin, New York State Inspector General Lucy Lang, and still others. So find them all in the Max Politics podcast feed after you listen to this one. And I have some great guests lined up for next week and beyond. And so stay tuned for all that. Also, as we move into our further discussion of congestion pricing here on the podcast today, I have already started to plan an event I'm hoping to hold in May here at New York Law School to dig deeper into the MTA, New York State, and New York City plans for implementing congestion pricing. So stay tuned for that. I'm hoping to have that in-person conference of sorts about congestion pricing implementation. But this conversation here will help tee that up as well. Okay, Gersh Kuntzman is editor-in-chief of Streets Blog New York City and USA. Gersh, hello, how are you? Thank you for being here.
Great to be here on a historic day.
A historic day. We are speaking here, as I said in the introduction, the day after the MTA board gave final approval to the nation's first congestion pricing program that will be coming to New York City. A lot of the infrastructure is actually already up around Manhattan, and they are planning to turn things on in mid-June, but we are speaking here on March 28th, and there's lawsuits still at play and some other question marks, but a big day with the MTA board giving final approval to the congestion pricing program. Gersh, biggest reaction you had, it was expected that they were going to vote it through, but sort of what was your broad, big reaction when it actually happened? You've been covering this, as I said in the introduction, for roughly two decades at this point in New York. What was your big reaction to this development?
Well, unfortunately, it was sort of anticlimactic because the MTA board was going to approve the toll figure. Once the toll figure was set late last year by the Traffic Mobility Review Board, it set in motion this vote on Wednesday. So that wasn't such a big deal. And, you know, as a newsman who's been covering this for a long time, and Gridlock Sam, a former City Department of Traffic commissioner, also put it this way, like, none of us is popping the champagne corks yet because so many things can happen, right? You mentioned the lawsuits, and also just, you know, you're always waiting for the other shoe to drop. I mean, I'm a Mets fan, so I feel like congestion pricing is like the Mets of urban development, you know, urban
traffic.
Mm-hmm.
As a fellow Mets fan, I makes me cringe to hear you say that. So say a little bit about the arc of covering this. You tweeted yesterday a photo of yourself at a press conference back in 2008, where you were covering congestion pricing related issues. That was obviously right around the time that Mayor Michael Bloomberg's push for congestion pricing was torpedoed in Albany. It took yet another 15 plus years for it to finally be enacted here. And again, you know, we're not counting any chickens before they hatch, but it looks like it's heading into enactment. Say a little bit about sort of the arc that you've seen and covered of the push for this program. What have you seen in terms of how it failed and then got over the finish line? What are there lessons to be learned from that? What are your reflections on sort of seeing the arc of this over the past couple of decades? How are you thinking about sort of the arc of this recent history around this really significant program?
Right. Well, I'll break that down in a couple of different ways. First of all, I think the first thing I ever covered with congestion pricing was back when the city wanted to just toll the East River bridges, and then borough president of Brooklyn, Marty Markowitz, was dead set against that. Just because people in Brooklyn were, their attitude was, why should I pay to drive into Manhattan? And that's the prevailing, I like to think of this, that's kind of the overarching difficulty that congestion pricing has had over the years, right? That drivers do not feel that they should be charged for what they consider to be a fairly normal act, driving from one part of a city to the other. I mean, the fact that New York has a river separating Brooklyn and Manhattan and Queens and Manhattan is to drivers nothing really. And in reality, people in St. Louis drive from one side of the city to the other without crossing a river, without being told. So there is a certain logic in the driver's mind about this idea of not being told to move about freely, which we are allowed to do as Americans. But, and this gets back to your question about the whole overarching history of congestion pricing. It was really the most recent attempt to get congestion pricing passed that succeeded because it connected the dots, which is your driving is undermining our city's ability to grow. For example, you're causing each driver causes a significant amount of congestion to all the other drivers. And then when you take the aggregate of that, you have gridlock, right? And gridlock is bad for the economy, especially in the e-commerce age. Nothing can move around efficiently, right? So if the cost of all of that driving is a detriment to our economy, that driving should be taxed, just like, well, you know, cigarettes were a detriment to public health and they became taxed. Alcohol is a detriment to public health. We're still free, as I well know, and you well know, free to drink, but we pay a tax on that for a number of reasons. One is to discourage the use, the other is to offset the public health detriments of that. So this latest congestion pricing plan, the genius of it, or the, if you're cynical, the political cynicism of it is, we're going to charge drivers to underwrite our transit system. The transit system, everybody, even drivers, acknowledge that the transit system is the lifeblood of the region's economy. And we're talking about just not the subway and buses, but also the Metro North and the Long Island Railroad, right? So if those were to fall into disrepair and decay, as they, you know, at various times in their history have, it costs a great deal of money to bring them up to what they call state of good repair. And the people who should be paying for that are not the users. I mean, we already pay as transit users very high fares relative to the operating cost of the MTA, right? Our fares underwrite the budget much at a much higher rate than other cities' transit users underwrite the budget. So you're not going to balance the books. You're not going to get back to state of good repair with massive funding on the users. So now we have to find a different funding source. And in this case, it's drivers. I mean, they're the ones who are causing damage to the subway system by siphoning off riders, but also damage to our region's economy.
Interesting. It was certainly key to getting this moving again in 2017 for Governor Andrew Cuomo to get behind it. And as you're getting at, part of that was around this twofold issue. One, was that the subways were starting to really break down. There was massive amounts of delays. There were some derailments. There were huge problems. And then there was the wrangling over how to pay for the MTA capital plan to fix service, to upgrade signals, to do all of the infrastructure work that is state of good repair work, not to mention expansion projects that are part of the capital plan. And clearly, part of the reason that Cuomo and even then Mayor Bill de Blasio, who had been a congestion pricing skeptic as well, came around to the program was as this funding source to have a new dedicated stream of funding through the revenue from congestion pricing to support the MTA capital plan. A, what are your reflections on the fact that it got done at that time and its ultimate passage in 2019 and Andrew Cuomo taking it on and being the executive that did get it done after it had failed back in 2008, under a different governor, different mayor, of course. And B, what has happened in the sort of intervening years? Obviously, there was a global pandemic. That's a significant part of the story. But what has happened in the intervening years as this has taken so long to get from passage in law in 2019 to implementation here? Potentially, likely in 2024.
Yeah, I'll start with the second part. I mean, what we're in right now is what they call the doom loop of congestion. I don't know, there's a word for it. The Jonas Ellison, who was involved in Stockholm's effort to get congestion pricing passed, talks about it. The chasm of support after just before something goes into effect, specifically congestion pricing, there's this incredible outrage about it. Even though, you know, when Cuomo passed it in the budget in 2019, support for congestion pricing was at its height. Well, it's collapsed since then. It's going to go back up once implementation takes effect because people are going to see that there's a benefit. First of all, drivers are going to see that there's 20% or 15 to 20% fewer cars on the road, so they will be able to get where they're going a lot faster. And they will realize that the toll is not that onerous in terms of the overall cost of owning a car, right? I mean, you know, we always talk about, oh, this $15 toll, it's going to break me. And it's a tax on the working class, et cetera. Well, people kind of they forget that the cost of owning, operating, leasing, whatever, buying a car is really high. And the $15 is a tiny part of it. People always say, well, I'm paying zero now, and $15 would be an increase. That's an astronomical increase. And sure, if you're counting it as zero right now, but you're already paying for gas, you're already paying for some other tolls, you're already paying for registration, you're already paying for the cost of the car, the cost of maintaining the car, et cetera. So the MTA estimates that if you look at the environmental assessment, the cost to drive every day in from Staten Island or from Eastern Queens or from Long Island is in the scores of dollars a day if you don't write off the sunk cost of buying the car, et cetera. So that's not, we're going to get back to support for congestion pricing once it's enacted because people will see it's working. Now, going back to the original question, you talked about like the change in heart, the political support that suddenly got behind congestion pricing. And you sort of pointed out, look, Andrew Cuomo is a car guy. There's no getting around that. The guy loves cars.
Bill de Blasio, too, to a different extent.
De Blasio loves being driven places, but now that he's no longer mayor, I guarantee you, yeah, I'm sure he takes cabs, but I've seen the former mayor, on the subway many times since he's been mayor. I almost never
And
saw
he
him on
was
the
also known for his, quote unquote, windshield perspective. Even as public advocate, I believe he used to drive himself around the city a lot. So his perspective has changed, but go
Yeah, now that he doesn't have a free car, I don't see
ahead.
him in a car very often. But the point about the political support is, like I said, Cuomo's a car guy, but here's a guy who, for many years, tried to avoid having the public connect him to the MTA. He would often say, I don't run the MTA, which is such total crap because he appoints the majority of its members or the plurality of its members. And he does, the governor does in fact run the MTA. And to her credit, Governor Hochul has not run away from that. She runs the MTA, she supports congestion pricing. She's been pretty clear. So I think what happened is he made a long-term effort to try to distance himself from his ownership of the subway. And that really did fail. I mean, everybody sort of knew, even New Yorkers who want to blame de Blasio for everything ultimately knew that Cuomo ran the MTA. So he eventually embraced congestion pricing and not de Blasio because he realized that, well, they're going to tie me to this anyway. I might as well find the funding. I might as well fix the summer of hell, which he identified, as you mentioned, The subway was in quite disrepair, and there was a lot of problems in the late teens. And so he did come aboard on congestion pricing. To his credit, now to his discredit, among all the other reasons you can discredit Andrew Cuomo, one of the main ones is recently he wrote an op-ed in the New York Post saying that it's still good policy, but this isn't the time, which is such a piece of craven politics, really at its worst, because if not now, when? I mean, this is exactly the time when we want to bring the subways back to full, if not even higher than full pre-pandemic numbers of riders. We want to encourage people to get out of cars. We're in a growing understanding of the global climate crisis. And plus, we have this level of congestion that pre-Uber and pre-Lyft didn't have. You know, obviously New York always had traffic, but there's more traffic now. It's documented. There's higher car ownership now. This is the thing that people often forget. They think that, well, congestion is just the Ubers and just the Lyft and just the e-commerce. Oh, there are tens of thousands, close to 100,000 more registered vehicles in the city of New York, privately owned, than there were before the pandemic. And that's a very short time frame to have so many more cars in the mix. So obviously something needs to be done.
The issue, there's a few things you just mentioned that I want to follow up on, but one is the estimate around how much this program will reduce traffic and congestion. You just cited this 15 to 20% estimate. Do you really think that that's going to be where it comes in? I mean, what sense do you have of how optimistic folks should be about how much congestion is reduced in the congestion zone? Because as far as I'm concerned, so let me couch this in part by going back to something you mentioned, which is about the cost of driving. As you said, $15 a day for someone who already owns a car, pays for registration, insurance, other costs related to driving. If you add 15, let's say you're driving into the congestion zone every day, let's say you do it 250 days a year, $15. You're talking another roughly $4,000 a year, right? So to your point, that's significant for a lot of people. It's also potentially the cost of the convenience that they want or the necessity in some cases of what they might want for driving into work or whatever it might be. So my thinking in a lot of this has been that 15 to 20% estimate is too high. That people will just pay the toll. A lot of people will just pay the toll. Okay, good for the revenue picture, but that the congestion reduction estimates here are too high. What do you think?
Yeah, I sort of agree, but I also think there's a lot of options the MTA has. First of all, if too many people are driving into the zone and traffic is not reduced, they have the flexibility to raise the toll, right? So then suddenly it would be a $20 toll or a $30 toll. We published an article in Streets Blog a couple of years ago saying, in reality, the toll should be closer to $80 a car because of all the delays and societal damage each car trip causes. If you calculate all of those car trips and divide it out, $80 would be the fee. Then you mentioned also,
Now you're getting people out of their cars.
yeah, right. Well, yeah, and then the
I
problem
mean,
is you might.
that is the thing. If you that's something I've wondered watching this whole thing play out is, do you try to hit a real tipping point where you're like really making it financially unlikely that people will just pay it? Then you might not hit your revenue tolls, but you make a real dent in the congestion issue. I mean, that's part of the issue around designing this program with writing it into law that it has to bring in $1 billion a year. But you were in the middle of saying
Well,
something.
it's twofold because you need that $1 billion, you can't make the toll so high that it truly eliminates traffic. Just like, in the case of cigarettes, they wanted to make the tax super high because they wanted nobody to smoke. But if you were just doing it as revenue, you have to find the sweet spot. And these are politicians who don't want to be perceived as attacking a broad segment of the population, in this case, drivers. However,
It's already happening.
However, drivers to the Central Business District of Manhattan are, as you pointed out, wealthier than their transit-using neighbors. Not that every driver is wealthier than a transit user. Obviously, in certain neighborhoods, it's the opposite. But drivers who go into the Central Business District, neighborhood by neighborhood, are on average richer than their transit-using neighbors. So what that means is these are the people you can soak a little bit. Not a lot, though, because they do have a certain amount of power as well. And politicians don't want to be seen as completely ignoring those people's, I shouldn't say needs because they're not needs, but they're those people's choices. And we as Americans, when we want to oppose something, we always say, well, we have free choice to do what we want. The fact is not, that's not true. In fact, we don't. We are taxed or told or feed in order to have so the government can encourage or disincentivize our encourage our good choices and disincentivize our bad choices. Like I said, it's true with smoking. It's also true with driving, right? We told we told the Whitestone Bridge, for example, not just to raise revenue, but to make it a little difficult, more difficult for people to just freely move around the area. And if to go back to the
Well, and as a way to pay for the infrastructure, right? I mean,
that's part of
it's
it.
a
That's
use
part of
of,
it. But there's a greater societal need to control the amount of driving people do. I mean, that's the larger issue here. And people don't, the politicians don't really want to talk about this very much because they don't, it's not the strongest, you know, ground policy-wise, but the fact is we do need to change people's behaviors about how they get around. Now, part of that is we do need to provide better transit so that they can get around. I think
I
that's
want to.
why that's why the anti-car group or the livable streets group, Transportation Alternatives, has that name, Transportation Alternatives, because if we all default to the car, nobody can get around. We all know that the vast majority of people who enter the central business district, whether they're coming from the suburbs or from the city, get there on transit. If that alternative is not strengthened, then it's going to decline. And as we've seen over time, the pandemic has had a created a loss in ridership that we haven't gotten even back to. And the result has been crippling congestion. So that's why congestion pricing, that's why Andrew Cuomo was wrong. This is actually the time to implement congestion pricing.
Oh, there's so many things you said that I want to go on. But let's stick with that one then, because the argument that Cuomo and others make is you've got a certain number of people driving into the congestion zone, into the central business district. A number of them have choices, as in, if you discourage them from driving, they will decide not to drive, but they won't necessarily get on the subway. And you risk losing whatever benefit you have of those people coming into the central business district, their participation in that economy. How much of that is worth examining, and how much does that rely on this issue of better transit service, safety on the subways, bus speeds, all of that that we also have to get into here, obviously, in this discussion, which is, I don't think in any way, shape, or form it's been made clear enough to people what those transit benefits are that are coming. Maybe some splashier announcements to change the narrative around congestion pricing. I know the Transportation Alternatives you mentioned, also the group Open Plans. You know, they've released these ideas for saying, hey, let's do some of these sort of exciting things to tell people this is actually good and a positive, but we haven't heard that much of that from the MTA, the New York City Department of Transportation, even Governor Hochul, who, as you mentioned, has been a very staunch supporter of moving congestion pricing to the point it's at now, you know, has not really unveiled a lot of that as a vision in terms of trying to really convince people that this is going to be a positive for them and they should leave their cars for the transit system. So say a little bit about that.
Well, there's two parts to that. One is some people will never be convinced. You can show off the shiniest subway cars, which they've just rolled out on the C train, for example. I get on the C train, it's like, wow, look at this car. This car's amazing. And you see that. You don't see better signals. You feel them in terms of better service, but you don't see them. So there's no way to roll that out. And the other thing is the MTA doesn't, unfortunately, control bus speeds as well as it could because the city, New York City, hasn't created enough bus lanes for these buses to get through traffic. When the city does do that, you see a marked improvement in bus speeds, and people on those routes definitely understand and see a direct connection to congestion pricing, funding, you know, transit service, and the ability to get around. So that's one thing. It's very hard to roll out saying, "Oh, it's going to be awesome." It's like, well, what do you? What's really going to be awesome? Oh, state of good repair. State of good repair is never shiny. Look, the
But
Whitestone
you can,
Bridge.
but I, you know, I disagree with some of what you're saying, which is on the signal upgrades, you can say you can sell signal upgrades as better, more consistent, faster service, right? I mean, that's what it is. And I know the MTA is trying to an extent, but the MTA is really, unless you have sort of someone, and again, this is not a slight on Jan Oliber at all, but if you have someone atop the MTA who's really out there to be like a real media salesperson, and Jan Oliber has done that to an extent, it's not really going to come from the leader of the MTA, right? It should probably come from the elected leadership.
Well, I mean, nobody trusts the elected leadership anyway. I mean, if the Mayor Adams took out a bunch of glossy ads about how awesome congestion pricing is, nobody believe it. That's not the point. But I was trying to make a larger point, which
Sorry,
is,
go ahead.
no, it's all right. The larger point is, drivers who don't currently take the subway or the bus are not necessarily going to be persuaded because, oh, the subway's so much better now. That's not the issue. They're going to be persuaded by the blunt force of a very high toll. And remember, there's not that many of these people. We're not talking about millions of people who drive into the central business district, A, and have a choice. Like, for example, the plumbers and hardworking blue collar workers always talk about this as a tax on them. People who have to schlep around hundreds of pounds of equipment are going to drive into and out of the central business district. And if you're a plumber and maybe you make three calls a day, you're going to pass that $15 along to your customers at a cost of $5 a day, and the customer won't even feel it. The same thing is true of all these people who say, well, I'm not going to drive into the city for a Broadway show anymore. That's total crap, and I'll tell you why. First of all, tickets to a Broadway show are like more than $150 a pop. The dinner that you're going to have, or the cocktail you're going to have after, you're going to go to Sardi's, you're going to see your friends. None of this is discouraged by a $15 toll. And if it is, the Broadway producers are going to realize that they can't fill their houses anymore, and they're going to drop the ticket price by $10, and suddenly it's all wash, right? There's a larger ecosystem of costs here. The fact is, everybody needs to realize, and drivers ignore this, the subway and the bus is still the fastest, most efficient, cheapest, and frankly, best way to get around the region. Now, is it the most convenient? No, it's not always the most convenient. My fiance and I, sometimes we go hiking in the area north of the city. We call it the suburbs, whatever. We'll take a Metro North train up there. We'll go see my parents up in Ridgefield, Connecticut. There's only two trains a morning, and there's only two trains in the afternoon, but we do it. Why? Because it's way cheaper. I don't have to own a car. Yeah, and sure, I have to get to Grand Central by 8 in the morning. And sure, I have a half an hour walk on the other end. But who cares? Like, yes, I'm able-bodied, I'm privileged, I can do that. If I choose to have a car, I sure as hell want society to make me pay for the deleterious effect of my driving on roads, on bridges, on my fellow drivers who are stuck in my traffic, on the citizens who are breathing my exhaust, on the kids who are stuck indoors because they can't play in the street because there's too many cars, et cetera. There is a societal cost to driving, and the more we
See,
recognize that, the sooner we're going to get off the crack pipe of driving.
I know that a lot of this is, you talk about issues like this or many other issues, and it always comes back for most people to how it affects them, their daily lives, their
Correct.
pocketbooks, et cetera. But the point you make about talking about this in a way that is sort of about a society-wide program that is important for the future of New York and New Yorkers, it does strike me as something, again, that's an important sort of way to talk about things that has not been talked about on this, right? Even when Governor Cuomo came around on it, mostly he said we need a way to fund the subways, right?
Right.
Some have talked about, again, reducing congestion. That's good for air pollution and asthma rates and things like that. There's, some of that discussion. But just this overarching pitch to people that this is really important and good for the future of New York, for current and future New Yorkers. I think, again, that's been sort of a missing piece of the leadership's message. And then, of course, you have to get into the nitty-gritty of all the things, that you've been talking about and that are mentioned in terms of costs and cost structure and convenience and congestion and all those things. But I do think that's been missed. And I think that ties into other things where, it gets to political messaging, press narratives, things like that, like the governor and her housing plan, for example, I feel like is another example of this where, you have to sort of really run these things like PR campaigns. You have to have the substance to back them up. But We live in this time of these information overloads, and the narratives get said and they compound each other. And if you're not filling the vacuum, or you're not filling the void, somebody else is going to fill it with an opposition message. And I think we've seen that happen on a variety of issues, including these two that I just mentioned.
Well, let me just stop you on that for a second, because I think that the messaging, at least from the governor's office and the MTA, has been very clear that this is about the region's survival, not just in terms of transit, but also in terms of being a low-level city in an era of climate change and rising sea levels. There's been no question that they've included that rhetoric in everything they've said. The reason that rhetoric doesn't take hold, and we cannot ignore this, is they are fighting I'd say about a 100-year war that the car industry and its enablers in politics have waged against the public. Just as the cigarette industry was a huge cultural force that was able to leverage its decades of advertising and decades of messaging to fight cigarette taxes and cigarette bans, as saying, well, Americans want choice. The car industry has been doing that as well for decades. For example, the car industry is the reason why we look at people who cross a street illegally as jaywalkers. The car industry is the force in our society that has demonized the victims of car crashes, because if car drivers were being demonized as they were in the earliest days of the car, when the car was introduced in society, pedestrians and other people in the cities of America were outraged. There was massive protests against the arrival of the car, almost as big, if not bigger, than the protest against the removal of the car. The car is an ahistoric factor in our urban life, going back to, well, the earliest cities. Obviously, the car is the interloper. The car is the newcomer. So you talk about messaging. That narrative you talked of, the press narrative, the political narrative, that's a narrative that is being built by the car industry, that we're nobody alive right now was not born in car culture, right? All of us were born in car culture. It's almost impossible. It's like asking the fish to describe the air. The fish doesn't care about the air. The fish is swimming in water. We are all swimming in that water. And that is the narrative that is almost impossible to break. Even nobody's saying you can't drive, right? Nobody's saying you can't drive. It's just saying you're going to have to pay a little bit more for the privilege.
I was going to say, car industry aside, there's lots of people where however it happened, who like the convenience of driving their automobile and want to continue to do so. But again, to your point, the government and society can come in and say, well, there's going to be an additional fee on that. I've found it fascinating to go back to, points about individual choice, people dealing with traffic or not dealing with traffic, the costs of doing business. I've always found it fascinating how many people right now choose to drive through the Battery Tunnel and pay the toll when you have the free East River bridges nearby. And they're making that choice to spend that money because they don't want to sit in more traffic that usually accompanies those bridges, right? And I find that to be a fascinating part of this discussion around this question of people being willing to pay a little extra for a certain convenience. And so you're saying, well, we're gonna add, those tolls to, in essence, add those tolls. They're not obviously tolling the bridges. And I wanted to ask you about that decision actually. But it's interesting in terms of people's unwillingness, some people's unwillingness to sit in that bit of extra traffic and pay the toll to go through the tunnel, and I always find that interesting anytime I'm sort of in a vehicle going over any of those crossings.
Well, people who own cars have been fed a lie, ostensibly, that you get in a car, it takes X amount of time to get there, and that's what it is. In fact, even Google Maps and Waze contribute to that because they never add in, for example, the time it takes to find a parking space, right? Or they do add in the traffic, so people then make a choice. That example you give of the Battery Tunnel versus, say, the Brooklyn Bridge, if you're a Brooklyn resident, the difference in time is often in the single digits of minutes. But the perception of time has become skewed because of, again, because of messaging by the automotive industry that says, well, you should be able to get where you want to go as quickly as possible. That's not true. Like, the fact is, we all bear individual responsibility for the big system of transportation. If the auto industry or the politicians were doing a better job of messaging, hey, transit will get you there faster, and they had the kind of money that the automotive industry has to back that up with ads and also service, eventually that would, and at various times in our history, that has been the case. People do realize the subway and the bus is the best way. Anybody who drives into the central business district from certain areas in the city that are really well served by transit, especially high speed transit like subways, is just bought a lie. I mean, it's like Orwell: freedom is slavery, war is peace, ignorance is strength. I mean, you can buy any lie you want. You can syndicate any boat you row, as John Lennon said.
I want to ask you about a few other things, get your perspective on a few other things here. You mentioned this idea that there is flexibility around changing the program, and that's sort of built into the system here and should be. And we've seen that in other cities around the world that have implemented congestion pricing, and they've tweaked it over time. And of course, with something like this, there should be that flexibility. So that's interesting. And I'm wondering if you have any, you know, sort of foresight predictions, not asking you to sort of guess the future here, but areas you think will be ripe for tweaking in the future. And that goes to the question of which pieces of the design here you think are most questionable, iffiest. Let me throw a couple things out there that I've always, you know, that I've felt were interesting decisions. I'm not necessarily saying they're wrong, but I do think the interesting decision to not toll the East River bridges, for example, to allow that movement from, let's say, Brooklyn over one of the bridges and then up the FDR Drive is not going to be tolled. And I thought that that was a pretty interesting decision that leaves continuing room for question. Another one being the overnight charges and whether those are too low to try to further discourage so many frequent deliveries, for example. And then the third being the question around one of the most sympathetic arguments, you know, I think that's out there. And I get that this may not be borne out by data, that it's a lot of people, is older people who drive into the congestion zone for medical appointments. They have double issues potentially in terms of, you know, age and some sort of illness, and they're going to one of, you know, many Manhattan hospitals for some sort of treatment or something like that. So those are a few areas that have always stuck out to me as question marks. I'm not asking you to defend all the decisions on these. I'm just wondering if you agree with any of that, if you think that any of those or something else will be areas where they are most likely to tweak the program or should have an eye out for things. Just your general thought on any issues you see with the design of the program or where you think they might be most likely to tweak in the future.
Well, you know, we had talked about in Streets blog, maybe there would be a once a month freebie, you know, that there are ways to tweak it. So if you have to go to the doctor and you are absolutely, you know, can prove that you have a medical disability, there might be a freebie. There's also, you know, if you have disabled plates, like legitimate disabled plates, you get exempt from that, mm-hmm. as well. And also, look, everything, as I said, everything's a system. So if suddenly all these senior citizens are complaining that they can't get to their medical appointments, well, there's a couple of solutions to that. One is AccessoRide needs to be better. And AccessoRide could be better if there's more funding for it, which is what the congestion toll is for. Number two, if you're a person who quote unquote needs to drive and suddenly there are indeed 20% fewer cars going into the central business district, then you're not just paying a tax, you're paying for better service, right? You're paying for better ability to get around. You know, taxis into the central business district are going to pay, passengers in taxis are only going to pay, it's like $2.25, I think, or depending on what type of taxi you use. Okay, so you're a senior citizen, hail a cab, call a cab. It's only a couple more dollars than it would be. That's another thing. What happens is, what I hear, and I'm sympathetic to a lot of people, but I'm not sympathetic to the argument that is underpinning all of these complaints, which is, well, I bought my car. I spent $30,000 on this car. I'm not just going to have it sit in the driveway or on the street for free, by the way. You're not going to just have it sit idle and have to hail a cab. Well, I would argue, and I've done the math on this personally, my personal life, I don't have a car because car ownership is a huge financial burden that I can offset anytime I need to. I got to move a couch from Costco. I got to move. I rent a car or I get a taxi. It is so much cheaper than owning a car. And this is the lie that the car industry has foisted on the public, which is owning a car is freedom. No, owning a car is a shackle. And if you do the math, I've debated Errol Lewis on New York One about this. He's like, well, I own a car. I want to go see my grandparents. I want to see my parents out in the suburbs. I see my parents out in the suburbs. I rent a car. I'm doing it this weekend. The total rental car for the weekend is like $250. If I do that 30 times, it's still cheaper than owning a car. So do the math is what I say to these people who say that they have to own a car or that there are so many other ways to get around that are in that moment expensive, but not over time.
You know, you're making me, well, first of all, I think car ownership can be both, right? It can be something that is somewhat freeing and also somewhat shackling. But your point about rental car, especially if you're a city resident and you're really only looking to use a car to get out of town on every other weekend, let's say, or once a month or whatever it might be, that model seems, you know, right there for some sort of bigger intervention that I know that there's been sort of car share pilots. I know that's more for getting around the city, but I don't know. I found it interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because I found it interesting that the idea of pushing people to give up their cars and rent cars when they need or use a car share model, that messaging hasn't really been there that much, or those programs haven't been there. There hasn't been any push for some sort of partnership between government and the private sector and the rental car market or things of that nature could be, I don't know,
Well,
interesting.
there's a vast reason why that doesn't happen. And again, it's because the entire country's policy, federal, state, local, is organized around helping the car industry. I mean, you see it all the time. This is an industry that is really subsidized, bailed out when it fails, et cetera. And so there's only the model in people's minds, buy a car or don't buy a car. And right, so like most people, a lot of people buy cars, even though they don't really need them. And then once they have them, obviously they have reasons to use them. And there, I don't know if it should be a public-private partnership. I don't think a private industry like Hertz or Avis should get public money, but there is a model, right? They gave them parking spaces for the car share pilot. And they found that fewer people bought cars as a result of having very easy car share near, you know, in a convenient way. Right now, they're doing a lot of work with electrifying the curb so we can have charging stations for electric cars. Now, I don't necessarily think that's a good thing because I think cars, electric cars are still cars and they still shackle the public in the same way, but I at least understand the impetus there to at least clean up the car system and make them have no tailpipe emissions. That's one improvement, but we're still connecting our society and shackling our society to car ownership. I really have to maintain that the reason we don't hear the narrative about car reduction is because there's just too many forces against it, right? Even the mayor, when he said we have to do congestion pricing right, that was his big thing. I mean, he doesn't own congestion pricing, he didn't support it, but now he's stuck with it, right? So his idea is like we have to do congestion pricing right. And what did that mean for this mayor? He said, well, he went to the MTA and said, I need you to exempt city vehicles from congestion pricing. So what that did is that
Which they
disincentivized,
did, by the way.
which they did. A couple 10,000 city vehicles might be exempted at the end of the day, which was going to lead to state vehicles being exempted and then federal vehicles being exempted, which is going to lead to less of a reduction of traffic in the congestion zone because, as Streets Blog has reported, a big plurality of the cars in the central business district are placarded state, city, and local, sorry, federal, state, and local cars. But anyway, to get back to the point, the mayor wanted the exemption for city vehicles. And what that means is he's no longer disincentivized from having the city workers drive, right? Because it's in his head. Well, they've got to drive. Oh, we know that a parks department worker with a big tree in the back of his truck has to drive, right? You can't carry that across town. You can't put it on the subway. But why does an ACS worker or a Department of Social Services caseworker need a city car? An ACS worker, however heroic that work she's doing is, and it is heroic, is traveling around with a pamphlet, right? Why does that person need a car? Why does the Department of Buildings Inspector need a car? The city is not disincentivized from driving at all. And like I said, a vast plurality of the cars, if not a majority, in the central business during the day are city vehicles.
What's the model city in your mind that if all goes well and there may be some potential tweaks over time to the system to improve it or follow this model, is there a model city you would point people to that you think has done this well and gotten it right? Is it London, which I know there's some debate at least over how they've handled it? Is it Stockholm? Is it somewhere else?
The parallel is not perfect because London City is a kind of a different animal. There's not a lot of residential. I mean, they've expanded their congestion zone a little bit, but initially it was very much a non-residential area. I'm going to Stockholm in May, so follow Streets Blog in May. You'll be seeing me in Stockholm. I actually think the model is a city that doesn't have congestion pricing is a city like Buenos Aires. I don't know if you've ever been to Buenos Aires or Bogota, Colombia. There is massive investment in public buses, right? So you're not going to dig subway systems. Even the MTA, other than the Second Avenue subway, which is a bit of a boondoggle, frankly, which predates the current leadership of the MTA, other cities do an incredible job with moving buses around. And to move buses around, there's really only one way to do it. Get the cars out of the freaking way of the bus, right? So in Buenos Aires and Bogota, they have dedicated, it's not just dedicated bus lanes. They have infrastructure. So the bus comes in and it pulls into a subway-like stop on a roadway where there's four bus lanes. So buses can pass each other as they go to the other stop. Buses are never stuck behind buses and they're never stuck behind cars. And if you can get from the equivalent of Park Slope of Buenos Aires to the equivalent of Central Park of Buenos Aires in 20 minutes, you're not going to drive. You're going to get on the bus. It's a dollar. It's crazy that we have leaders in this city who they always say, well, New York is different. New York, what do they call it? New York exceptionalism. We're so different from every city. Well, first of all, we're not. Human beings are the same. We've been the same since the ancient times. The difference now is we want to get around fast. Okay, you want to get around fast, get the cars out of the way, put in a dedicated bus rapid transit system, which is incredibly cost effective because you're not digging a subway tunnel. Digging the Second Avenue subway, the reason it took so long is because it's really hard. There's buildings up top, there's sewage, there's other electrical systems. Building a bus rapid transit system, we already have roads. The New York City Department of Transportation redesigned Third Avenue in Manhattan. From, you know, Third Avenue is like an 8-lane highway. Now you got a lane of parking on both sides, so now it's 6 lanes. Maybe you got a bus lane, now it's 5 lanes. It's still like 5 lanes of traffic. So what'd they do? They turned it into 3 lanes of traffic, a dedicated bus lane, a bike lane. It's still not enough. That should have been a car-free street with 4 bus lanes going in both directions. And then you could still have the cars on Second Avenue, First Avenue, Lexington, et cetera. They didn't do that. So our big joke about that was, hey, DOT, 2009 called and it wants its bus lane back. I mean, that design was such a missed opportunity, even though it does have a bus lane, it has a bike lane, et cetera. But it's ancient, it's horse and buggy thinking. We need to move people from the village up to Harlem in 10 minutes. That was a missed opportunity.
So this gets me to, you know, what we'll end on in our last 5 minutes here, which is a little bit more about how to make sure to try to get this right. There's a lot of ideas out there, as I mentioned, from advocacy groups, think tanks, et cetera. There's things that the MTA has in motion, mostly related to its capital plan, which funding from congestion pricing will help make sure that system state of good repair happens, as well as movement on expansion projects. Some of that action, as you, I think, mentioned earlier, has been delayed because of the delay to congestion pricing and the delay to that revenue coming in, although a lot of things got delayed via the pandemic.
Yeah.
The New York City Department of Transportation told me a couple weeks ago when I was saying, hey, what do you guys, you know, and I know you ask this all the time at Streets Blog, but I said, you know, what do you guys have in motion? What's out there? Can you send me any stuff that you've either announced or things that relate to the implementation of congestion pricing? And they sent over a bunch of projects they have underway in Manhattan related to bus lanes and bike lanes and pedestrianization and things like that. They also said more announcements would be coming soon. But say a little bit about ideas that are out there that you like or things that you think the city and or the MTA should be doing to make sure this goes well. Any fun, creative things out there that you like? How do they you mentioned at the very beginning of this conversation, we've seen the expected big dip in approval of this right before it goes into effect, right? As there's a lot of news attention around, here comes the toll, and there's a bunch of drivers that are upset about it, et cetera. How do government leaders with, a push from advocacy and others help ensure that positive momentum as it goes into effect, ensure that people feel the positive effects, embrace this new system as it comes online, as we expect it to do in mid-June? What are the things out there that need to be done? What are ideas that you like? What are some positives that could be on the horizon here?
Well, I'll start by saying they've already failed because the experience of the other cities was
I was giving you, I was teeing you up for positivity.
I will get. People have this idea. Gersh Kutzman, he's such an asshole. But the fact is, I'm a very positive guy. But I want to just
I'm
make it
kidding.
clear that they've already failed at the first hurdle because other cities that have done congestion pricing made a lot of changes before congestion pricing went into effect, so that people would immediately experiment with the buses or the subway. They'll say, "Hey, you know what? They're going to toll me. I'm going to get on the bus. Oh, wow, the bus worked amazing. I'm excited." So they didn't do that. Now, going forward, I'm a big bike guy. I love bikes. I think it's a great way to get around. But I don't think that's the solution because still the numbers of people who are taking the bike to get into the city, get into the central business district is still going to be low compared to transit, right? Because millions of people take transit and tens of thousands of people bike. So do the math on that. It's a factor of 10, if not 100. But so there's where the opportunity is, right? Make the buses work. The subway already more or less works, right? I can get from my home in Windsor Terrace to the Midtown in half an hour, and it really, except for rare occasions, it doesn't work. It's fine. It really is. The buses are where tens, hundreds of thousands of people are stuck, right? So if you're going across the Bronx, east-west travel in the Bronx is almost exclusively on buses, and it stinks. Now, you're going to say, well, how does that affect congestion pricing? Well, it affects it a lot. If we keep people out of their cars and get them on good bus service locally, they'll take good bus service or good transit service into the city. And there are opportunities. Now, you say, well, what are the things on the horizon that you're excited about, Gersh Kuntzman? I'm excited about whenever the city talks about a bus project, but they don't. In fact, this mayor, and you want to talk about politics, you're a political guy. The mayor has, and I think rightly, I hate to say it, but I think rightly, made a political calculation that the livable streets issues that Open Plans and TransAlt and Riders Alliance push is not does not have enough of a political upside to distract him from the other things that he thinks has a political upside, like crime in the subway, his housing plans, which some of which are actually pretty good, et cetera. He knows as loudly as Gersh Kuntzman at Streets Blog or Open Plans or TransAlt is going to yell, that yell is not as loud as the Fix Rikers crowd, the housing crowd, et cetera. And he's probably right about that. However, that doesn't absolve him from the responsibility of helping his fellow New Yorkers get around and also by following the law. He's under legal requirement to build 30 miles of dedicated bus lanes per year. Last year, they did in the single digits, it was like 6 miles. That's an abomination, and he needs to be sued over it. I don't know if he will be. I've asked the council speaker about that, and she's not really up to suing him. But the fact is, if he was building 30 miles of bus lane network every year, at the end of his mayoralty, which is probably only going to be a year and a half, frankly, because I don't think he's winning a second term, but who knows? No one's
Let's
running
not
again.
get into that now.
Yes. But if he were to have built all those bus lanes, he was required to build like 150 miles of dedicated bus lane. You'd have an actual network, a Buenos Aires, Bogota-style network of functioning buses across this city. Fordham Road, Queens Boulevard, Northern Boulevard, Flatbush Avenue. You ever take a bus up Flatbush Avenue? Well, I don't recommend it unless you've
I
got
have.
agita medicine. So the point is, if you could get from Mill Basin to downtown Brooklyn in 15 minutes instead of an hour, you would take the bus.
So I think you're hitting on something that is clearly the essential piece as we wrap up, which is the bus situation. I mean, I understand you were moving to mostly focus on the buses, but I do think there's ways the subways could be even more sort of efficient, timely. If you figured out again ways to boost up some of that service a little bit, get people out of their cars a little more because they feel like I'm not waiting any more than, 4 or 5 minutes for a train, and I'm moving when it, when it comes. But I agree with you that mostly the subways have been good. There's obviously these random attacks and issues around subway safety that need to be dealt with. But overall, I do think the subways are running generally very well. And the key issue really is the buses. And this is just something where I agree with a lot of your political assessment there in terms of the mayor's calculations, to a significant degree, but it's also really confounding because he did not come into office kicking and screaming about having to fulfill the streets plan requirements. He talked about exceeding them. And so this has been really confounding because it's not like something like pretty quickly how he was instituting his public safety plans and the population at Rikers was going up and he was pretty quickly saying the old Rikers plan isn't going to work. We need a plan B. He wasn't coming into office saying the streets plan is a mess. We need to alter it. And so, and it's a fact that many of his core constituency communities and voters are bus riders. So that to me is really, sort of the way to conclude the conversation is to say, the buses are really the key linchpin here, which again could coincide with this broader vision for what the city is and where its mass transit system is going, including a reduction in congestion on the streets and getting people out of cars for the subways and the buses. But we've yet to see that. And again, there's a window now. I also think, I think it's very interesting, and I'm interested in your final thought on this in terms of there is a relationship between the state, the MTA, and the city on the buses, where you have this proposal in Albany, right, where they're very likely going to include more funding in the state budget again for fare free bus routes, for giving the MTA more money to run buses more regularly. There's the plan by Assemblymember Mamdani and Senator Gennaris, who pushed through the first round of funding for some fare-free bus pilots previously, and now they're back for more. So you're going to probably see that in the next state budget. You have the MTA, where we've seen officials express frustration at the MTA that the city's not doing more on the buses, right? But that hasn't quite boiled over, and everybody's playing very nice. And I wonder if maybe sometimes playing too nice, where if there was more pressure from the governor and the MTA on the mayor to move forward on some of these bus mandates and promises, that you'd see more action. But a final thought on sort of all of that relationship and what actually makes a difference here in getting the bus situation addressed.
Yeah, the buses begin and end with the mayor. Like you mentioned, those politicians in Albany are indeed going to get more funding for buses. But it's not a matter of, like with the subway, you can increase service. If your signaling is good, you can increase the actual number of trains. With buses, there's a point at which just putting more buses on the line doesn't help because they're stuck in traffic. This mayor, you're right, the MTA has been very diplomatic with this mayor. A little bit less recently, and at a recent council hearing, it was pretty clear that members of the council were questioning the MTA, saying, what are you doing about the buses? Can you push this mayor? And, that they put their hands up a little bit. But it was pretty clear, look, they need to pressure the mayor. The buses, I don't know why I keep going back to buses. Buses are the best car reduction strategy. They're the best congestion strategy. They're the best climate change strategy. They're the best pollution strategy. And they're frankly just the best getting around strategy. And
on top
not that
of
expensive.
The subway system.
Right. But they're not that expensive. In other words, for the mayor doesn't have to buy the buses. Right. But he does have to get rid of the cars in their way. That's not that expensive. But you do have to take on entrenched driving.
It's actually
interest.
Revenue raising.
Right. You don't. But you have to take on the entrenched driving interest. And we did a story right after the mayor got elected. His support, the coalition he had cobbled together, broke down along certain ethnic lines, certain racial lines, certain geographic lines, but it also broke down around driving lines. Neighborhoods with a higher than average percentage of drivers who commute via car voted for this mayor. So I have to believe that's part of his calculation too.
Well, we will leave it there, Gersh Kuntzman from Streets Blog. Thank you for the time. There's a lot more to follow up here on the buses. You mentioned the city council that passed the streets plan law doesn't necessarily want to sue the administration, but we did hear speaker. We have heard a lot of frustration from the council about the administration not following through on those mandates. A number of issues raised at oversight hearings, budget hearings. And we did hear the city council speaker dedicate a portion of her recent State of the City speech to that, said they're going to pursue legislation requiring a capital tracker from the system. Again, you know, these, I understand if people want to scoff at some of this because it's, you know, it's, again, requiring more reporting and all of this stuff that's not actually necessarily going to move the needle, but it is attention on the issue where she didn't have to, you know, include it in her State of the City, right? So there is more pressure. And I think between now, talk about a little bit of optimism. I do think between now here that we're speaking with the final passage from the MTA board, there are lawsuits pending. But between now here that we're talking on March 28th and mid-June implementation, I do think we're going to hear some significant announcements from the city, hopefully in conjunction with the MTA, about things that they're doing to make the rollout of congestion pricing attractive, optimistic, positive about the future of the city and the region. And I do think that that will happen. That's an optimistic prediction from me on this. So
you're an optimist.
I've been called worse. Gersh Kuntzman, thank you very much for all the time and thoughts. And everyone can read the work you're leading at Streets Blog and appreciate it. And be well and stay in touch.
Thank you very much.